Well, it's been quite a journey for Daniel and his friends. Many lessons learned along the way. First of all, the lesson of not just standing back. Jeremiah 29, the message came to those who were sent into exile, Daniel amongst them. Seek the peace of the city. Don't embrace, but engage. That was the lesson that Jeremiah taught them. But at the same time, don't get sucked in. Don't let them squeeze you into your mould. Be distinct. So Daniel takes a stand on this issue of food that's offered to idols. And the meal itself is an act of worship to the idols. He takes a stand on that because idolatry is something that God's people have had a problem with. And he is dealing with that in them. And don't give up. Because although the kingdom is great, Nebuchadnezzar is a great king, and he was. Babylon is a great nation, and it was. There is this dream given to Nebuchadnezzar, this statue of gold, silver, bronze, iron and clay, and iron mixed together. And the idea is that these kingdoms will come, and they will go, and they will go, and they will pass. One king will pass to another, another kingdom will pass to another. And so it will go on. But there will be one king, a heavenly kingdom established one day that will grow to fill all the earth. So don't give up. Don't give up. You may be from a two-tribe backwater that once was Israel, but don't give up. Because the kingdom to which you belong will become the ultimate kingdom. And don't be proud. Don't be proud. Rob Hunter a few weeks ago in the morning dealt with Belshazzar's feast, which is why I'm skipping over it in Sunday evenings. But we had Nebuchadnezzar in chapter 4, who had to be humbled before he humbled himself. But he did. And the Lord raised him up again. Then Belshazzar in chapter 5 was warned, didn't listen. Pride filled his heart. Two kings, Nebuchadnezzar and his grandson Belshazzar. One humbled himself, one refused to listen. Because God deals with the humble, the brokenhearted. That's the way into the kingdom. That's the way into under his reign. When you come knowing you've got nothing to give, actually, you've got everything but baggage. And you bring it all and God accepts all of that. Cleanses you, forgives you, and lifts you up. It's been quite a journey for Daniel and his friends. But probably nothing quite touched this one. You see, there's a plot. Verses 1 to 9. There's a plot. A new king comes to power. Belshazzar, his kingdom ends in one night. And Darius the Mede comes to power. He's 62 years old, we're told. Daniel at this point is probably in his 70s, possibly even in his 80s. Okay, he's not the young man in the lion's den. And this prominence, this rise to power for Darius means there's a cabinet reshuffle. And there are now 120 men, we presume good men, efficient men, organized men. They're set up over the whole of the country. And it was a big country. And they were to report to three men. And Daniel is one of them. And we're told in verse 3 that Daniel, above them all, distinguished himself. There's an excellent spirit was in him. And the king gave thought to setting him over the whole realm. Did the king speak about that to the other governors? Possibly. Possibly not. Did the king speak to that to the satraps, those who would report to the governors? Probably not. But somehow they've got whiff of this inclination. And they've had enough. The governors, verse 4, the satraps sought to find some charge against Daniel concerning the kingdom. They want rid. But the problem is, nothing sticks. Nothing sticks. There is no fault. There's no negligence. There's no weakness. They can't get any muck to stick on this guy. They can't stand before Darius the king and say, get rid of him because of this. There's nothing at all. No wonder the king wants to promote him. So the only way they can do it is use his faithfulness to his God, which is the result of his success, or the cause of his success, use his faithfulness to his God to put him between a rock and a hard place and cause him to choose. Now they know when it comes to a choice, he's not going to choose any other way. He's not going to leave his God now. That's what they're counting on. So they come up with this plan. And in one sense, it's a very cunning plan, isn't it? Very cunning. Kings of this day were used to setting themselves up as deities or channels of deities. And so for a king to ask people to pray to him isn't as bizarre as it might seem to you and I. But it is peculiar, isn't it? Huge kingdom, many gods, pray to me for 30 days alone. Why, king? What would you do? What power have you got? What authority have you got? But you see, that's not the issue. The issue is there's a diverse kingdom, and this could unite. This could unite. Probably that was one of the selling points. But notice the poison in the plot. Verse 6, the governors, the satraps, they thronged before the king. Can you imagine the scene? There's 120 of satraps and there's two other governors. And it looks like, if not all, then certainly most are there. And they all say with one voice, "We think this is a good idea, king." All governors of the kingdom, the administrators, the satraps, the counselors and advisors have consulted together. You see the poison in that? It's not true, is it? There's one man left out. They may have consulted together, but Daniel has not been consulted at all. They suggest this decree, this writing that should be made. And as we're told a number of times, the problem for the king will become that once a law is made, that is it. It can't be repealed or changed. So that's the plot. King, there's no objection to this. Go on ahead. Make yourself God for a month. Therefore, King Darius signed the written decree. So there's a plot, but there's also the pit, the den. Daniel, remarkable really. Do you get connection? Now, when Daniel knew that the writing was signed, he went home, and in his upper room, with his windows open toward Jerusalem, he knelt down on his knees three times that day and prayed and gave thanks before his God, as was his custom since early days. They knew, didn't they? They knew. He's going to pray. He's going to pray. He's always doing it. And his house is likely to be a busy place. Servants everywhere. People coming in for appointments all over the place. And so him having a private moment is highly unlikely. So he goes up to this upper room. He opens the window and looks towards Jerusalem. Not because it's a holy direction, but because he needs encouragement, as one writer suggests. Encouragement to pray. He's not home. And he wants to pray for home, where God's people should be in God's plan. And they've got him, haven't they? They knew he wouldn't stop praying. And so they rush to the king. And the men, they assembled, they knew where to be, because they knew what they would see. They found him praying, making supplication before his God. They went before the king, and they spoke concerning the king's decree. Did we not make a rule? Did we not make a law? Yes, we did, says the king. Well, that Daniel. That Daniel, who is one of the captives from Judah, does not show due regard for you. Now, the king doesn't hold much weight on that phrase, but it's frightening, isn't it? This is the best man in the kingdom they're talking about. And they're able to write him off. He's from another place. He's a captive from Judah. He's no regard for you, nor the decree you've designed. But he makes his petition three times a day. And it's not to you. And the king realizes, doesn't he? The king realizes, oh. This nice idea of the law, oh, the one man he never wanted to catch, the one man he never wanted to get into trouble, was his best man. He's cornered, isn't he? And we're told that he does everything within his power to keep Daniel out. But the king is powerless. And even to the point where, as Daniel is put into the pit, the king himself has to use his signet ring to seal, to press on his seal, to indicate that he is willing for this action to take place. How ironic is that? But Daniel goes in. But before he goes in, the king has this quiet word. Your God, verse 16, whom you serve continually, he will deliver you. I'm laughing because it's almost funny. Do you see the change? The king has said, everybody in the nation, pray to me. And about one day later, he's realized he has no authority at all. He can't even stop a man being thrown into a den. But he's confident that Daniel's God is different. Your God can deliver you. I might not be able to, with all the power that's vested in me in the nation, but your God, that's a different story. He'll deliver you. Stone was brought, laid over the mouth of the den. King sealed it with the ring and the others. And he waited. Now, you've had sleepless nights. Some of you had sleepless nights recently. You'll have sleepless nights again. But I don't suppose you'll have sleepless nights about an issue like this. He is responsible. His thoughtlessness is responsible for having a man whom he loves, respects, adores, wants to work for him, or wants him to work for him. He's in the den. He's got no chance unless his God comes through. So you have a plot, you've got the pit, and then you have this proclamation, because Daniel's God does come through. This king goes without everything. No food, no sleep, no entertainment, nothing. He just cannot rest. Rushes to the den. And what a telling line this is. He came to the den and he cried out with a lamenting voice to Daniel. How desperate is this man? Powerless, but desperate. He cries out this question, has the living God been able to serve you, or been able to rescue you, whom you serve continually, been able to rescue you from the lions? O king, live forever. Those words must have been sweet on his ears, eh? And Daniel explains, my God sent his angel, just like Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego. In the fire, there was a fourth man. Well, in the den, there was a second man. And this angel, many would insist that this is the eternal Son of God in a pre-incarnate form, has come into the lion's den and he shut the lion's mouths. Now, if you look up children's storybooks at this point, you see Daniel using a lion for a pillow. Or a duvet, actually. Depending on which... Now, that may or may not have been the case. But just to reinforce the point that it was completely miraculous, the events that follow are sobering. The men who carried out this plot, they, their wives and their children are thrown in. Why? It was probably the custom. But could the king trust these men? No, he couldn't. They used him and his power against him. Can he trust them? No. And as they are put into the pit, we're told that the lions overpowered them and broke all their bones in pieces before they ever came to the bottom of the den. Now, we ought to be horrified But the recording of that fact is so that you see and I see how miraculous the rescue was. These lions weren't lazy. They weren't tame. They hadn't had too much to eat the night before. They had miraculously had their mouths shut. And once that had been taken away from them, once Daniel was up and out, not a scratch on him, they returned to what they were trained to do. Do you see how miraculous that rescue is? And the king is exceedingly glad, verse 23. All right, that is it. That's a jam-packed phrase, okay? I read one version that said the king was happy. It's significantly more serious than happy. The king was exceedingly glad for him. And he took him out of the den. And not a scratch. Does that sound familiar? When Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego came out of the fire, there wasn't even a hint of smoke or any damage done at all. This was complete protection. And so Darius writes this letter. This is a paraphrase. I, the king of the greatest kingdom in the world, am telling you that there is another king. There is somebody else who has authority and power. He is the living God. Verse 26, halfway through. Very interesting. When you think about it for a second, Nebuchadnezzar the king was dominated by a dream of succession. That one day his kingdom, the kingdom of represented by the head of gold in the statue, would pass to another and become a kingdom of silver under the reign of somebody else, Darius. And that would pass to another, and so on and so forth. He is, power is a daily exercise for him. He's used to power, Nebuchadnezzar is, but he lives under the shadow of succession. As does Darius. He's used to power. He can reorganize a government a cabinet of 120 plus men. And he needs to do that to run the kingdom well. He's used to power and authority. And he lives under the shadow of succession. He's just come to power and he's scared of what's coming behind him. And when they see power and authority like this, the protection of men from a furnace so hot that it burns the men who throw the characters in. The protection of men, or a man, from lions who devour hundreds of people before they hit the ground. When they see power and authority like that, they acknowledge they are seeing something utterly unique. And so both men talk about dominion and the everlastingness of the kingdom of this God. Both men talk about that. And here Darius says that. He talks about his dominion being the kingdom of men. But they must tremble in fear because he's the living God. His kingdom is the one which shall not be destroyed. There is no succession. There's no one more powerful. There's no one who's going to come after and take over what he does. He is it. The greatest ruler. And I, king, I'm telling you, fear him. He delivers, verse 27, he rescues. He works signs and wonders in heaven and on earth. And he's delivered Daniel from the power of the lions. And Daniel outlives this king, Darius, and serves under another called Cyrus. You have a plot, which is cunning, close to brilliant, if you like. You have the pit. And you have this proclamation. There's no God like his God. Folks, there are many lessons we can learn from this. I'm going to suggest to you three. And they come in the form of three questions. What happens to God's disciplined people when they receive that discipline? You might think, hang on a second, what are you talking about? Well, don't forget, Daniel is the exiled people. The two tribes of remaining Israel have been conquered, taken away by Nebuchadnezzar into Babylon. And that is not just success of Nebuchadnezzar. It's actually a handing over of God, of his people, to another ruler. Why? Because they have idolatry in their hearts. And that needs to be dealt with. So he gives them over. He sends them out. In other words, they're under discipline. Not punishment, but discipline. Because God keeps a remnant. He keeps men like Daniel and others faithful to him. And they are learning that their God is worthy of all worship. That the idea of making an image or adopting another deity from another pagan religion, that idea would be completely put out of their minds. And so the general brushstroke of the story is this: what happens to God's disciplined people when they receive that discipline? Well, God honours them, doesn't he? God honours them. Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego, and there are others. The story of Esther, for example, would be a good example. People who received the discipline of God. They looked to God even though he gave them over to another ruler. They submitted themselves underneath his reign that he would do what he pleases because he does what is best. And here we see, as elsewhere in the whole story of the book of Daniel, we see those who humble themselves under the disciplining hand of God. God honours, he lifts up. There are two forms of discipline that you and I can go under in the church today. One is called formative discipline, which is where we cause us to grow, train us to stay in the healthy boundaries of God's will and way. And then there's corrective discipline, where someone will say, God is not pleased with that. Think again. Come back. Both are just as valid. Both are just necessary. If you have corrective discipline without formative discipline, the church will fall apart. If you have formative discipline without corrective discipline, the church will fall apart. You need both. But friends, as we stand with and for each other and remind each other of what is good and holy and pure and right, let us receive from each other the discipline of God. Let us grow and gladly imbibe what is good for us. Don't play with fire. So what happens to the God's disciplined people when they receive that discipline? He honours them. And he holds on to them. What happens to God's godly people in ungodly situations? What happens to God's godly people in ungodly situations? This is more immediate in this story. Well, in the response of Darius to Daniel, Darius loves Daniel, doesn't he? He's going to promote him. He's the best worker he's got. He's the best mind, the best man that he's got in the kingdom. He loves it. Why? Because an excellent spirit is in him. So there's this connection. A pagan king wants to put under the whole kingdom. He wants to put the whole kingdom under this man because this man is brilliant. You see that? There's this respect and admiration for what this man is because he belongs to God, because of the characteristics and attributes that are his through his faith. But it's not all smooth, is it? Because there are 122 men around him and below him who'd rather get rid of him. Who'd rather get rid of him. And so the response that we can expect as we seek to live godly lives in an ungodly situation is what? Some people will respect us, even admire us. And some people will hate us, be envious of us, want to get rid of us. Domestically, that means you may have a hard time from somebody in your family. Somebody's constantly having a jibe at you for your faith. Gladly point out your faults when you say things that are less than honourable to the Lord, should you say that? Point the finger, accuse. Professionally, it may be the case. You may find that you're overlooked for a job, a task, a responsibility, even a promotion, because you stand for integrity. Of course, it may be the case that you get a promotion like Daniel because you are a man or a woman of integrity. But don't expect everybody to love you for it. See, the Bible tells us this, that we've got to work out our salvation with fear and trembling, knowing that it's God who works in us. And without complaining and disputing, that you may become blameless and harmless children of God, without fault in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation. Faultless in the midst of filth. Among whom you shine as lights in the world. That's what Daniel was like, wasn't it? He shone brightly in the midst of all this filth. And we're called to do that. But the same man who wrote that, in another letter, Paul writes this, 2 Corinthians chapter 2. For we are to God the fragrance of Christ, among those who are being saved and among those who are perishing. To the one, and here's the two responses. To the one, we are the aroma of death leading to death. They see you, they hear you, they observe you, they hate you. Because you remind them of what they are not, and they hate you for it. Your characteristics, your attributes, cause you to do well. They hate you for that. To the other, you are the aroma of life, leading to life. They see you, they observe you, they watch you, they hear you, they love you. What are we to expect? Both. Which means when we have one, we're not puffed up and think life is smooth. And when we have the other, we're not completely despairing, thinking that this isn't worth it. Both. Think of Daniel. Darius, the others. What happens to God's godly people in ungodly situations? Don't expect a reception that's warm or a journey that's smooth. You won't get it. But always count on God who will hold you fast. Do you get it? No matter where you go, no matter who you're with, no matter what responses people have to you, God has you. And as he proved to Daniel, sometimes that can be remarkable deliverance. What happens to God's disciplined people when they receive that discipline? When we humble ourselves before God, he honours those who humble themselves. What happens to God's godly people in ungodly situations? They're loved and they're hated. Expect both. What happens to God's kingdom as other kingdoms come and go? That's the last question. What happens to God's kingdom as other kingdoms come and go? Well, Daniel's life is a little picture of what's happening to God's kingdom. How many kings does he outlive? Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar's son, who we hear little about. Then Belshazzar, his grandson. Then Darius. Then Cyrus. Those are a mighty fine collection. But all through them all, Daniel stands firm. Why? Because the kingdom his God is building will last beyond every reign, beyond every rule. President, king, queen, it doesn't matter. Prime minister, doesn't matter. Every kingdom will come and go. God is then and now building a kingdom. And that is supposed to comfort us no end. Because one day, the king will return. And one day, all those who have looked to him as king here on earth will be part of the great kingdom. That will, as Darius himself says, never end. Christian. You will receive respect and love and adoration because you are Christian. You will receive persecution and trouble and heartache because you are Christian. And the kingdom you belong, the kingdom that Christ is building and building you into, will never end. And so you see, it is always worth it. It is always with that eternal perspective that we press on. If you were here yesterday, that prospect is a marriage feast. Why? Joy, light, hope, love, union, abundance. It's a wonderful picture. Your God is making a kingdom of which you and I are graciously part of. Don't give up on Him. Because as He proves to Daniel, He never gives up on His people.